I'll introduce Jeremy Smith to provide his paper. Jeremy has been at on Green's list and been at our bar since 2003. In that time, he's developed an extensive junior practice in commercial law with particular emphasis on equity, probate and trusts, and also employment law. And Jeremy, in that time, in those 7 years, has been involved in many Part 4 applications, both at trial and also cases that have settled prior to trial. And he will discuss primarily the decision in Forsyth and Sinclair.
Thanks, Tony. I'm going to, as Tony indicated, I'm going to talk about the Court of Appeal decision in Forsyth and Sinclair, but before I do that, I'll be spending some time on the decision which was the subject of the appeal, the decision of Justice Harper, and I'll also be talking about the Court of Appeal's subsequent decision where they considered the costs application on the appeal and some interesting points which were thrown up in that decision. I've prepared a paper for today, and I've set out on the first two pages the provisions which the vast majority of you will be very familiar with, but I thought I'd set them out anyway because some of you may be just dipping a toe in the water for the first time. The fundamental proposition is that the court has jurisdiction to adjust the distribution of the estate assets in certain circumstances. And in a case where the court chooses to exercise that discretion, it will have dealt with three questions, and those three questions are set out at paragraph 2 of the paper. Did the deceased have responsibility to make provision for the plaintiff? Secondly, did the distribution of the estate make adequate provision for the proper maintenance and support of the plaintiff? And thirdly, assuming the answer is yes to the first question and yes to the second question, what provision ought to be made in the circumstances? Now, of course, those questions are to be considered with reference to the list of factors in section 91, subsection 4, which all of you will be familiar with. Those of you who are less familiar with it will see some similarities with the list of considerations set out in the Family Law Act when dealing with disputes between parties who are in that jurisdiction. Now, the case came before His Honour Justice Harper and it concerned the estate of Mr. Malcolm Forsyth, and at paragraph 4 I've set out some observations about Mr. Forsyth and his estate. He died aged 63 in 2004. He was not married. He lived in a house which he and his brother owned as tenants in common, and it was the house he and his brother had grown up in. His brother lived elsewhere with his wife and children, and his brother, whose name was Campbell, and I'll refer to him as Campbell, was the executor of Malcolm's estate, and he was the sole beneficiary under the will. And it was significant that the will was made in 1973, so by the time Malcolm died, the will was a bit long in the tooth, and that was a significant matter in the end. And the estate was valued at just under $800,000. Now, Campbell was rather surprised when along came Marlene Sinclair, and Marlene made a claim for provision, which is the subject of Justice Harper's decision. She came along and she said she'd been friends with Malcolm, and that when her marriage broke down in 1992, their relationship became intimate. And in paragraph 5, I've set out just a sentence from His Honour's decision which encapsulates her proposition. She said, "We made a lifelong commitment and said that we would just spend as much time as we could together, that we would look after each other no matter what, and we would get married when we could." Now, that sounds like the sort of statement that a lifelong devoted partner might make, except for the fact that they didn't ever get married. They maintained separate homes for the duration of their relationship, and indeed Marlene continued living with her husband after they separated, living under the one roof with him. They were not financially dependent upon one another, And at no stage in the 15 or so years of their relationship did they mention a word of it to Campbell. Now, Campbell wasn't estranged from Malcolm. Campbell was a brother. They had a close relationship. They didn't live in each other's pockets, but there was no reason why, on the face of it, Malcolm wouldn't disclose the relationship to Campbell. And those facts really are central to this story. They're what make the case unusual, and the fact of non-disclosure to the brother makes the path the litigation took understandable. Now, at trial, Marlene led evidence from about a dozen witnesses. They gave evidence, all of them, of an intimate and committed relationship which they had witnessed at first hand. They were generally friends and acquaintances, and their evidence was quite compelling. And one couple in particular gave evidence that on an occasion Malcolm had said that he wanted to provide for Marlene in his will should he predecease her. And the sort of evidence which these people gave was that the two of them had been seen, or rather Marlene had been seen by neighbours leaving Malcolm's home of a morning. He'd been seen farewelling her. They'd attended interstate functions, and at those functions Marlene and Malcolm treated one another as partners. Malcolm had expressed his love and affection for her. They visited and stayed with friends overnight. They had an exclusive sexual relationship. Friends sent them letters and gifts together, and so on. So those were that was the sort of evidence which the plaintiff led. And it was filled out with little details from these witnesses, and it's a very good way when you're preparing affidavit material in this jurisdiction to bring a particular relationship to life. Just short, sharp evidence from people who knew the parties involved. Now, Campbell, in the executor running his case, called evidence or led evidence from his wife, himself, and other people who were perhaps not as close to Malcolm, people like his accountant. And the thrust of that evidence was that Malcolm had never mentioned the relationship to any of them. Campbell and his wife hadn't seen any signs of the relationship. Malcolm's house, and quite a lot was made of this, Malcolm's house was a pigsty. It was dirty, it was dusty, it was... by the way, it sounded barely fit for human habitation. And the suggestion from Campbell's side was, well, if you really cared about him, you wouldn't have let him live in those circumstances, particularly given that he had a skin condition which would be aggravated by all that dust. And finally, they said Marlene hadn't made a will in favour of Malcolm. Now, His Honour assessed all this evidence and found that it indicated a relationship of deep and intimate affection. And he also found that probably the reason Malcolm didn't disclose any of this to his brother is because he thought that Campbell and his wife wouldn't like Marlene. He was able to explain away the maintenance of separate residences by the fact that their respective residences were close to where they worked. Marlene also had two children who she needed to look after. In terms of Malcolm living in a pigsty, His Honour said that Marlene was not really in a position to do much about it. And finally, he found that Campbell's scepticism of this claim was quite understandable in circumstances where his brother simply hadn't told him. He made no criticism of Campbell. He said that Campbell simply didn't know. Now, in the course of His Honour's decision, His Honour made only the briefest reference to some of those Section 91, Subsection 4 considerations. He said, I've also taken into account 91.4 E, F, G, H, L, M, and had reference to those sections. So he was very short and sharp in the way he referred to those parts of the Act, and that's something which was considered on the appeal. His Honour also placed emphasis on the fact that the will was made in 1973, and whilst in 1973 this will may have been entirely appropriate, it was not in fact appropriate in 2007 when he died. So, coming back to the three questions which any judge must deal with in this jurisdiction where a claim is successful, His Honour found that Malcolm did have a responsibility to provide, make provision for Marlene. The distribution of the estate left her nothing, so plainly it did not make adequate provision for her proper maintenance and support. And in exercising his discretion, His Honour determined that Marlene was entitled to one half of the estate. And His Honour, in that regard, looked at her financial situation and decided that she should be able to, in his words, make significant inroads into her mortgage so as to allow her to boost her, ultimately boost her superannuation savings. So it's something of the providing a roof over the head and a nest egg for the longer term. The decision was appealed by Campbell, and the appeal was heard by Justices Neave, Redlich and Habersberger. The grounds of appeal fell into three categories. Firstly, and I've set them out at paragraph 14, the characterisation of the relationship. The appellant said it was contrary to the weight of evidence. Secondly, and it flows from that, the finding, they challenged the finding that Malcolm had a responsibility for provision, to make provision. And thirdly, he challenged the exercise of discretion, that is to say, the award of one half of the estate. Just one observation on the appeal grounds. They run to about six pages of this decision. It's a 38-page decision when I printed it out. The appeal grounds run to about six pages. They are very long, and they raise just about every issue one could conceivably raise out of this decision, and I'll come back to that in the context of the costs decision. The lead judgment was written by Her Honour Justice Neave. She made very short work of the first ground of appeal, namely that His Honour had erred in characterising the relationship in the face of the evidence. Her Honour described that part of the appeal as hopeless and made the observation that whilst Campbell sort of inferred that adverse findings had been found against him in that his evidence hadn't been accepted, in fact, that wasn't the case. He didn't know about this relationship, so no adverse findings were made against him at all. His evidence was accepted. It's just that he didn't understand or was not in a position to understand the nature of the relationship. Now, the second ground of appeal was concerned with the proposition that Malcolm had a responsibility to make provision. And this part of the decision commences with a consideration of the authorities and reference to the phrase in Collicote and Macmillan, the criterion, that the relevant criterion is the criterion of what a wise and just testator would consider his moral duty. And there's some discussion of the fact that the phrase moral duty was referred to with some disapproval by the High Court in Singer and Berghaus, but it's apparent that the Court of Appeal in a sequence of decisions, and again in this decision, considers that to be, that phrase to be, the best way to encapsulate the various elements that need to be brought together by a court in deciding one of these cases. So use of the phrase moral duty is very much remains a significant part of this jurisdiction. Now, this second ground of appeal is really at the heart of this decision. The appellant put a number of propositions. One of them was that for the purposes of Section 91(4)(e), which deals with the types of relationship which might give rise to a claim, there's reference to an other relationship. And the appellant said that such a relationship had to be a family relationship, or a relationship which resembled a family relationship, and the appellant suggested that because this was not a conventional de facto relationship, it didn't give rise to a moral duty. Now, the court pointed out that this question is really about making a value judgment in relation to any relationship. Also pointed out that the circumstances in which a testator might be found to have a moral duty are not static, they change with the times. And the court observed, and you'll see on page 7, or Her Honour commented, I would reject the appellant's submission that 91(4) requires the existence of a relationship akin to a blood or family relationship. So that's a very important finding out of this case. Her Honour went on to note that, in fact, this relationship did, in fact, possess many of the attributes of a de facto relationship in any event, and by present community standards, most people would agree with the proposition that a testator does have a moral duty to take care of his or her de facto partner. The court also referred to the decision of Justice Kaye in Unger and Sanchez, wherein His Honour found a moral duty was owing to a friend who cared for an elderly couple in their later years. And the court, in this case, pointed to that case as support for the proposition that an orthodox family-style relationship wasn't really a condition of a successful claim. And that decision will be, Unger and Sanchez will be dealt with by Anita shortly. Finally, on this part of the appeal, the appellant criticised the judgment on the basis effectively that not all of the Section 91(4) considerations had been taken into account by His Honour. Again, the Court of Appeal made fairly short work of this. It went through them one at a time, and it noted that and I've set them out at paragraph 21. Malcolm probably had no responsibility to provide for Campbell, who was the sole beneficiary under the will. It noted the size of the estate, essentially that there was enough money to go around. It noted Marlene's proximity to retirement. It noted that they did in fact share some expenses, not fundamental living expenses, but some recreational expenses. They noted Marlene would have trouble discharging her mortgage. And they noted that Malcolm had said that he wanted to provide for her. So that was the second ground of appeal. The third ground of appeal concerned the exercise of the discretion by His Honour, and the suggestion was that he had erred in awarding Marlene one half of the estate. And I'll just run through the court's findings here briefly. They're set out at paragraph 24. The court referred to the need for judges to take an instinctive synthesis approach to these claims when there are lots of different considerations which need to be taken into account. The court also said that it was not necessary for Justice Harper to repeat his analysis of all of the considerations required under the Act when dealing with this third question, the exercise of the discretion. He'd already done that in the earlier part of his judgment. He didn't have to repeat it for this section of his judgment. And secondly, thirdly, the court pointed out that arithmetical precision in these cases is not possible. You can serve up the same case to many different judges and get many different results within a reasonable range of results. As I say, Her Honour Justice Neave wrote the lead judgment. Justices Redlich and Habersberger agreed with Her Honour, although Justice Redlich, I've said in paragraph 25, seemed less than overwhelmed by the case. He described it as being a case which was at the margin of the cases or the circumstances in which relief might be awarded. He also notes that the findings at first instance, which His Honour made and which were appealed, were plainly open on the evidence. Now, so that's the Court of Appeal's decision and His Honour's decision at first instance. His Honour had awarded costs on the out of the estate, and there was no issue raised on appeal about that. The The Court of Appeal then had to consider the question of who should pay the costs of this appeal, and they handed down a decision in August. The respondent on the appeal, Marlene, said that the appellant, Campbell, should pay the costs out of his own pocket on the basis that A, he'd acted unreasonably in bringing the appeal, and B, it was artificial for him to say that he was protecting the interests of the estate. In fact, as the sole beneficiary, he was just protecting his own interests. The appellant said, of course, the cost should come out of the estate and that he didn't act unreasonably. Now, the court found that the court looked at different aspects of the appeal. They said that in relation to challenging the analysis of Justice Harper and the proposition that there was a duty to provide for Marlene, the court said it was clearly arguable that the decision in this case had stretched the boundaries too far, given the unusual aspects of the relationship between the testator and the respondent. As Justice Redlich said in his judgment, it was a case at the margin. So the court had no difficulty with Campbell bringing the appeal insofar as that part of it was concerned, but the court said that the challenge to the factual findings was unreasonable, and on that basis it reduced Campbell's entitlement to costs by one half. And that's why I made the observation about the number of pages that the appeal took up in the judgment. They appealed every possible point, and ultimately Campbell did that at his detriment, because hidden in there was a very good point, but he decided to challenge every finding that Justice Harper had made, and that cost him in the end. Now, the final observation I'd like to make, I'm sorry, there is one more observation which is really obiter, but in the course of this decision, in paragraph 27, and I haven't mentioned it in the paper, the court makes this observation about costs generally in TFM cases. We consider that it is a matter of concern that in many family provision cases, the amount available for distribution amongst the competing beneficiaries is significantly reduced by legal costs. Parties should not assume that litigation can be pursued safe in the belief that costs will always be paid out of the estate. Every effort should be made to resolve the dispute before the costs get out of proportion. However, it takes two to settle a dispute. Unless sensible offers of settlement are made in a form which can be referred to subsequently, it is very difficult for the court to allocate responsibility for the dispute not settling. All that can be done is to conclude that where costs have been incurred unreasonably, as here, they must be borne personally. I take that to be the Court of Appeal saying that if you make an offer of compromise, it should be given, it should be treated appropriately by the court, and it would be interesting to see a decision from the court where it considers that question in more detail. The other thing this decision made, and which Tony referred to in his introduction, is that it made some observations about the disclosure of matters at mediation and how, if they are disclosed, they might be relied upon in a costs argument subsequently. I've set out the detail of this in the paper from paragraph 29 onwards. The situation was that the respondent filed some submissions in writing in support of her application for costs. Now, the day before the appellant's submissions were due in response, the respondent wrote to the appellant and said, look, we would like your permission to raise with the court something that went on in the mediation of the appeal in 2009, which had been conducted by Associate Justice Gardner. The appellant filed his submissions and then said he also wanted to consider a newly raised issue. So at that point, the court didn't know anything about this issue and didn't know that the respondent had asked the appellant whether they would object to material from the mediation being raised. The appellant then went ahead and filed a further submission detailing his version of what went on at that mediation. And I'll just read, because it's interesting, I'll just read from what was contained in that submission. Counsel for the appellant set forth his version of what had relevantly occurred at the 2009 mediation. In addition, the submissions went on to set out a chronological list of demands by the respondent, offers of settlement by the respondent, call to bank offers by the appellant, and account of some of the negotiations at a mediation held in 2005. So that came before the court in the form of submissions. The respondent then wrote to the court saying, well, hang on, all we did was ask the appellant whether we might be permitted to refer to the mediation in 2009. That's all we've done, and now they've gone and disclosed all of this. So the Court of Appeal had to consider this mess. The court went straight to Section 24A of the Supreme Court Act, which the parties hadn't, in fact, turned their minds to. And that section states that where the court refers a proceeding or any part to mediation, unless all the other parties who attend the mediation otherwise agree in writing, no evidence shall be admitted at the hearing of the proceeding of anything said or done by any person at the mediation. So obviously you can't refer to a mediation or what went on at any stage without written consent. There's also a provision in the Evidence Act, section 131, subsection 1, which prohibits the adduction of evidence of a communication between the parties in connection with an attempt to negotiate a settlement. But there is an exception to that provision in that it can be raised if it's relevant in determining liability for costs. But the court said that that doesn't overrule section 24A and mediations are effectively sacrosanct. The court then found, though, that for the purposes of section 24A, when the appellant put in this lengthy submission, it had in fact consented in writing to the disclosure of material arising out of the mediation in 2009, but it had gone well beyond that in disclosing all of this other information. It described it, perhaps in a, something of an understatement, as an unsatisfactory way to proceed. So it's an interesting sequence of decisions from Justice Harper through those two decisions in the Court of Appeal, and there's some interesting questions which I think will be revisited by the Court of Appeal in the future. Thank you.
Thanks, Jeremy. I think you'll all agree that Jeremy has very lucidly and amply demonstrated that Sinclair and Forsyth isn't just another Part 4 decision. It's a significant decision involving matters of principle, law and procedure, and to us, the all-important question of costs and how certain matters that one doesn't turn one's mind to immediately rise in significance when the matter comes before the court in arguing over both the incidence and the quantum of costs. So thank you, Jeremy, very much for that exposition.